I'm Nahla Ayed, host of Ideas. In this age of clickbait and online shouting, Ideas is a meeting ground for people who want to deepen their understanding of the world. Join me as we crack open a concept to see how it plays out over place and time and how it matters today. From the rise of authoritarianism to the history of cult movies, no idea is off limits. Ideas is on the CBC Listen app or wherever you find your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hello, I'm David Common, in for Pia Chattopadhyay. Welcome to the Sunday Magazine podcast, featuring the stories we first brought you on Sunday, May 12th, on CBC Radio. Been another dynamic week in the ongoing Israel-Hamas war. First up, we'll help you make sense of it. From the latest in ceasefire talks to America's shifting approach towards Israel. After that, they can communicate, interpret touch, and engage in social behavior. But does that make plants intelligent? We'll dig into the latest research and debate around that question. Also today, a look at new questions being raised about the killing of Canadian Sikh separatist activist Hardeep Singh Nijjar, after revelations that men charged with his murder may have links to a notorious Indian gang. And later on, our Sunday documentary takes you to Michigan to see how the battle for working-class voters there may shape this fall's U.S. election. It all starts right now on the Sunday Magazine. It has been another critical week in the Israel-Hamas war, one that started with talks of a ceasefire and soon gave way to further fighting. On Monday, Israel began its long-anticipated offensive in Rafah, where over a million Palestinians have been sheltering from the conflict in Gaza. Yesterday, it ordered thousands more to evacuate the city as it steps up attacks. And all of this has prompted strong reaction from around the world and, crucially, from the United States. It has begun shifting its approach to Israel, with President Joe Biden warning he could hold back more military aid if the Rafah operation escalates further yet. So plenty to unpack today, and Greg Karlstrom is here to help us do it. He's the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. Greg, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me again.
Clearly a few days can make a world of difference in this war, but I want to go back to Monday because the context is important to understanding how we are where we're at now. Hamas announced at that point that it had agreed to this ceasefire proposal mediated by Egypt and Qatar, and then very shortly after that, Israel rejected it. Can you remind us what the terms of the deal were and why it fell apart?
Right. And the problem now is that both Israel and Hamas have agreed in principle to ceasefires, but they haven't agreed to the same ceasefire. They've agreed to two modified versions of the same Egyptian proposal. So the basic framework of it is that there would be a three-stage pause in the fighting. The first stage would last about 6 weeks. During that time, Hamas would release around 33 Israeli hostages from captivity. There would be a second stage, also 6 weeks long, where they would work towards what they called a sustainable calm in Gaza. And that was a diplomatic term of art meant to paper over the fact that Hamas wants a permanent ceasefire and the Israelis only want a temporary ceasefire. And so that wording was meant to fudge the difference between the two. And then if they somehow managed to reach a sustainable calm in Gaza, Hamas would release all of its hostages, and then there would be a third phase where the war would officially end. So that is both for Israel and Hamas the broad outline of what they'd agreed to. But the problem is this proposal that Hamas agreed to on Monday in several important ways is not the same one that the Israelis endorsed last month.
And so in the aftermath of that, we see Israel going in the opposite direction from a ceasefire, beginning airstrikes in parts of Rafah, demanding that people evacuate, beginning to move in part in ground by ground in limited areas. Why move forward at this point in Rafah?
Well, they haven't gone, first of all, we should say, they haven't gone into the city center itself. So what they have done is begun on the periphery. They've taken a few kilometers of what's called the Philadelphia Corridor. It's a strip of land between Egypt and Gaza. They've taken the Rafah crossing between Egypt and Gaza, which is quite significant in terms of the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza, but they have yet to go into the really densely populated parts of the city. So why are they going forward with this? It depends on who you ask. You know, the official line that you hear from the Israeli government and the Israeli cabinet is that they think military pressure in Rafah will put more diplomatic pressure on Hamas to make a deal that is more amenable to the one that the Israelis are willing to make. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that, you know, Prime Minister Netanyahu, for months now, he's been trying to, on the one hand, go ahead with ceasefire talks, on the other hand, keep threatening this Rafah offensive. And many of his right-wing coalition partners are losing patience. They don't want Israel to keep indulging in diplomatic talks. They want Israel to go ahead with this big incursion into Rafah. And I think Netanyahu, finally, in the past week or so, has felt compelled to start approving something, even if it is a more limited version of the offensive his coalition partners want. He's felt compelled to begin that process, that offensive.
And I suppose the question is, to what end? Because in order to keep his government going, he has to listen to those within the coalition government. But Israel itself is hardly united behind either him, his government, or this effort.
It's not. It's certainly not united behind his government. Just about every poll going back to October says that two-thirds to three-quarters of Israelis want him to resign. And then, as you say, even on the question of whether to do an offensive in Rafah, there was a poll that came out in the past week from the Israel Democracy Institute, a think tank, a centrist nonpartisan think tank in Israel. And it found that 62% of Israelis and 56% of Israeli Jews think it is more important to make a hostage deal right now to try and get as many hostages out of captivity as possible. They think that is more important than doing a military offensive in Rafah. So there is majority support for a diplomatic agreement right now with Hamas, the only group in that poll that showed majority support for an offensive in Rafah over a hostage deal was right-wing Israeli Jews. And that's the crux of the problem, because that is Netanyahu's core base of support.
There is also the question of what comes after, whatever after looks like. We have seen different phases of this war from the Israeli military. They've pulled out a very large number of their soldiers at various points, left something of a power vacuum, a vacuum that Hamas can go in and fill. Is there a sense that Israel's military, Israel's government has a plan for after?
No. The short answer is no, not at all. I mean, we're seeing just in the past few days, along with this Israeli military push into part of Rafah, they've also begun offensives in a couple of places in northern Gaza, in Jabalia and Zeytun and a few other areas of the north. These are places that the Israeli army went into back in October, November, December, back when the ground offensive was at its heaviest and there were tens of thousands of Israeli troops in northern Gaza. They went into these areas on the ground. They bombed them quite heavily, but then they withdrew most of their troops from these parts of northern Gaza. And what we've seen over the past month is that if you leave a power vacuum there, Hamas will try to fill that power vacuum. And so the Israelis find themselves over and over again now going back into areas that they thought they had cleared, where they thought they had removed Hamas from control, because there is no plan, there is no political plan for what to do afterwards. The Netanyahu government has rejected just about everything that's been proposed. Talk of bringing the Palestinian Authority back to Gaza, Netanyahu is not willing to indulge that. There's been some breezy talk about Arab peacekeepers or an international peacekeeping force, but that hasn't really gone anywhere. There is no plan for what happens after the war. And so that means Israel is just dragged into over and over again, having to return to areas that it thought it had cleared.
Let us talk not just about the politics on the ground, but the politics internationally. And most key to that, perhaps, is the relationship with the United States. U.S. President Joe Biden has been steadfast since the Hamas attacks on October 7th. But we have seen a shift, and a shift that has taken on greater speed and urgency. On Thursday, Biden announced the U.S. would stop supplying some weapons if Israel launches a major ground operation in Rafah. What are we to make of the speed at which there seems to be a shift from the Americans now?
Well, I think how much of a shift this actually is in practice, I think that's the question on everyone's mind right now. The Americans, a couple of weeks ago, withheld a shipment of 2,000-pound bombs, very large guided bombs that Israel had ordered that were meant to be delivered in the coming weeks. America withheld that, didn't announce that it was withholding it, privately told the Israeli government that it was withholding that shipment, and it was withholding it to send a message, as you say, about the offensive in Rafah. The Israelis then leaked the fact that it was held, and the Americans were forced to eventually publicly acknowledge this. And then we heard President Biden in his comments on Wednesday night to CNN saying that he would withhold certain offensive weapons. But what does that mean in practice? Is it just going to be America withholding a handful of deliveries of 2,000-pound bombs? Is it going to be a more extensive arms embargo on Israel? We don't know quite how far the administration is going to take this policy. And so, you know, the fact that it's been announced at all, the fact that there's been even one arms shipment delayed, is certainly of concern to the Israeli military, which cannot fight a sustained war without American resupply. It certainly caused a lot of controversy in Washington. Republicans are very critical, even some pro-Israel Democrats in Washington, very critical of the president's decision. But I think, you know, as with so much of the talk over the past 7 months about Biden losing patience with Israel and Biden changing policy on Israel, I think we sort of have to wait and see how far he's willing to go with. This is a policy shift. It's a real policy shift. Mm. But how far is he going to go with that shift?
And the degree to which Netanyahu would listen to him. I mean, Netanyahu was at the end of last week saying if Israel has to stand alone, it will stand alone. What does that say about the Biden's leverage over Netanyahu? Is there any?
Well, Netanyahu has spent the past 7 months trying not to make a decision. You know, he has, again, on the one hand, his right-wing coalition partners who want this war to go on until what Netanyahu has called total victory. And on the other hand, he has centrist members of his war cabinet, Benny Gantz, Gadi Eisenkot, people like that. He has the international community. He has the Biden administration, all of whom are now pushing for a hostage deal and what they hope will be an end to the war. And Netanyahu, who has been chronically indecisive throughout much of his political career, he's honed that into an art form. He's done it again over the past few months. He has tried to, on the one hand, pursue these hostage talks, but on the other hand, leave open the door to an offensive in Rafah. And he's now in a position where he effectively has to choose. Does he hold his government together? Or does he alienate the United States in the process? Or does he stay on good terms with the Biden administration, relatively good terms, and risk blowing up his government? And honestly, everything he has done over the past 7 months suggests that he's going to prioritize domestic politics. He wants to prevent early elections. He wants to prevent a possible state commission of inquiry into what happened on October 7th and the failures afterwards. And the only way for him to do that is to keep his coalition together. So I think given the choice between international opprobrium or domestic political consequences, he's going to choose the former.
Is the only way to keep his coalition government going to keep the war going?
It seems that way. I mean, the alternative is to make a deal. If he makes a deal, he will certainly lose the far right members of his coalition. He might even lose some people from within his own Likud party who have called on him not to make a ceasefire agreement, a hostage deal. Now, there are people in the opposition, Yair Lapid, the opposition leader, for example, who has said if there is a ceasefire deal, if Netanyahu agrees to it, and if he needs opposition votes in the Knesset to get that deal through, that they will, for a short time, be happy to vote with Netanyahu, be happy to join his government temporarily, but only to facilitate a ceasefire and a hostage deal. And once that deal is done, the opposition would go back to being the opposition. So I think if the war ends, if there is a deal to end the war, then Israel is, in a matter of months, headed for early elections that he seems set to lose.
Let me step away from Israel's domestic politics and go back to the international stage for a moment and talk about the United Nations General Assembly. It voted overwhelmingly to endorse Palestinian membership. But it doesn't mean a lot, because until the Security Council goes along with it, a council where the United States has a veto, it doesn't actually grant that full membership. Israel's ambassador, however, to the United Nations responded by saying that it had welcomed, to use his words, a terror state into its ranks. What does it say that the United Nations has gone and taken this action, the General Assembly has taken this action, and that while the United States voted against the resolution, Canada, in a first for this country, abstained. What does it say that some of Israel's strongest friends are seemingly shifting their positions, if ever slightly?
I think that's exactly what is significant about this. It's easy to be cynical almost about any individual step that the Palestinians have taken at the UN over the past decade and a half, because so many of them are symbolic, including this one. As you say, it doesn't upgrade them to being full members. It's largely a symbolic decision. But you look at the direction of travel over the past 15 or so years since the Palestinians began this effort to become a member of the UN, to join various UN bodies and international treaties. Since they began that effort, there is growing support from some of Israel's traditional allies, from countries in Europe, from countries like Canada. There is growing support for the idea of Palestinian membership, Palestinian statehood at the United Nations. That is a real shift over the past 10, 15 years. We also see things like the Palestinians, because they became a observer member of the UN about a decade ago, they were able to accede to the Rome Statute, which created the International Criminal Court. That made them a member state within the ICC. And the ICC is now using Palestine's membership in that court as justification. They're using that to claim jurisdiction to investigate war crimes committed in both Israel and Gaza since October the 7th. So there are real, you know, international law implications from Palestine's membership being upgraded in this way at the UN. So yes, each one of these decisions, you can say it's symbolic, it doesn't amount to much in and of itself. But I think if you look at the overall sweep of the past 15 years, the Palestinians are gaining some real powers or some real recognition internationally. And they are, as you say, they're bringing around even some of Israel's closest allies to the idea that Palestine should be treated like a state. And that is a very real shift in international politics.
Can I finish off with something you were speaking about just a few minutes ago? And that is Netanyahu's benchmarks. If he is using the language of total victory today, he was using the language that many Israelis were using in the aftermath of the October 7th attacks, and that is the eradication of Hamas, which had perpetrated those attacks, the worst in Israel's history against civilians. Is it possible, in the eyes of those you speak with within Israel's military, is it possible to eliminate Hamas?
I think it depends a bit on what one means by eliminating Hamas. I think, is it possible to eliminate it as a governing entity in Gaza? Is it possible to eliminate it as a well-armed and well-organized military actor? If that's the definition, then I think the answer is probably yes. And you see other examples in the recent history of the region where ideological militant groups have been degraded to a point where they're no longer able to serve as influential actors. You saw that with the campaign against Islamic State. You saw that with what the Sisi government has done to the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt since the coup there in 2013. It is possible to seriously degrade militant groups or ideological groups. Is it possible to eradicate them entirely so that there is no one left in the Palestinian territories who supports Hamas? No, I think that's unreasonable. And I think even most Israelis would say that is unreasonable. But I think, again, the problem is, if you want to do that, if you want to replace Hamas as the sovereign in Gaza and you want to weaken it to the point where it can no longer carry out an attack like October 7th, there needs to be some sort of alternative governing structure in Gaza. And that has just been completely absent from the Israeli war planning over the past 7 months. And if they are not willing to come up with some sort of serious governance plan and security plan for post-war Gaza, then no, it becomes impossible to eradicate Hamas, because they will inevitably try to reemerge and fill the vacuum that is left behind.
Greg, we'll leave it there with our thanks.
Thank you.
Greg Karlstrom is the Middle East correspondent for The Economist. All right, let's shift gears now here on the Sunday Magazine. It is Mother's Day, just in case you forgot. And perhaps you will be getting or gifting some flowers or a houseplant for the occasion. Maybe you're getting your hands dirty as gardening season gets underway. Well, Zoe Schlanger wants us all to look beyond the beauty of our flora to see a fascinating side of plants that scientists are still uncovering. Zoe's a staff writer at The Atlantic, where she covers science and the environment. And in her new book, she shines a light on the latest research around the potential of plants to communicate, interpret sound and touch, engage in social behavior, and so much more. It's called The Light Eaters: How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth. Zoe Schlanger, good morning and welcome to the Sunday Magazine.
Good morning. It's great to be with you.
Well, we're very glad to have you. This is a fascinating book and a fascinating topic, but I got to go back to sort of before the book and ask you, your regular beat deals in pretty dire stuff: climate change, water crises, air pollution. What was it that said, I got to pivot to plant research?
Well, I think you probably could sense some of that just in listing those topics, why I might have. This is depressing stuff that I typically work on and have returned to working on now. Covering climate change is a brutal job, as probably any of your listeners know. It's just all bad news. And I was sensing myself getting a bit numb to this bad news, even though the news was pretty catastrophic. I mean, we're talking about melting glaciers, wildfires. I just started feeling like, well, that's another good story, which is always a good sign for any journalists listening. It's time to change your beat. You can't act or come from that place when trying to write about a subject.
Yeah, I totally understand the idea of a pressure valve.
Totally. Yes. And so plants were the pressure valve for me, or the release. I started paying attention to botany journals. Science reporters have access to scientific papers before they come out. And I was just browsing the system and realized that botanists, who are a very conservative bunch, like all scientists, were actually debating whether or not plants could be intelligent. And I mean, this sort of made me fall off my chair the first time I realized, because it seemed so improbable that something so boundary-pushing was something that they were actually printing in scientific journals. And I knew if scientists were talking about it in public like this, there was definitely a story here.
Yeah, it is controversial. And can you break down why that is, why there are different views in the debate about, and I mean, it is a controversial thing to say, are plants intelligent?
It is. And probably the most central reason it's controversial is because plants don't have brains. We can't find a brain. There's no brain in there. And it's not like us to ascribe intelligence to something that doesn't have a brain. I mean, the idea of animal intelligence is new enough that extending that realm to a brainless organism is a pretty far-fetched concept. But the reason there was a debate is that because of improving technology and a sort of waning away of old biases against doing this kind of research, scientists were finding incredible things that plants could do, finding that they were very active creatures with the ability to make decisions and behave spontaneously and communicate, like you said, and have these social lives. And that really made some of them pause and say, should we not expand the definition of intelligence to also include this sort of brainless intelligence? Could you make a mind from something other than a brain? And then you have the other side of the folks who are saying, it does a disservice to plants to even put the word intelligence on them. They are not little humans. And when we think of intelligence, we think of ourselves. So we're layering this human dimension on them that does a disservice to their central plantness. The incredibly awesome things they do that are nothing like the things we do.
That is a very human thing to do, though, to anthropomorphize all sorts of discussions.
It is, which I think has its benefits, actually. We are creatures who learn from metaphor. I think that sometimes it's by help of the better known that we can help teach ourselves about the unknown. And in this case, plants are the ultimate unknown. They're these little aliens that we hardly know anything about. And so sometimes using human metaphors can be useful, but scientists are very worried about us taking that too far, of turning them into these little cartoon characters or little deities or something like that.
Okay, let's jump right into some of this groundbreaking research that you got to see firsthand, including at a lab in Wisconsin, and this plant that had a tangible response to being pinched.
Oh, yeah.
You got to tell me what happened, but also your own sort of human takeaway.
Oh, yes. This was a shocking moment for me. I went to the lab of Simon Gilroy, who's a professor at UW-Madison, and he is using plants that have been imbued with this fluorescent protein from glow-in-the-dark jellyfish, and he's using it to track a signal moving through the plant. And so he went into this dark microscope room, and one of his researchers handed me a pair of tweezers and told me to pinch the leaf of a plant that was under the microscope. And at first I pinched it kind of gingerly because it felt sort of cruel to do. And they're like, no, you have to pinch much harder. And I pinched hard enough to break the midrib of, you know, the middle vein of a leaf. And then I saw on the screen that was reading out from the microscope, this green light sort of emanate from the place where I pinched it, slowly moving throughout the entire plant. And within about 2 minutes, the green had moved through the whole plant in this honestly vein-like pattern that is very reminiscent of our own kind of nervous system pattern.
Yeah, and like sensing pain. Oh, it reverberates through your body.
Exactly. Now, of course, plants don't have brains, so presumably have no pain receptors. But this plant absolutely knew I was pinching it. And this felt so intimately shocking to me because I had been researching plant intelligence for a couple of years at that point. And most of what we learn is invisible to us. You can't see the chemicals plants use to communicate that are drifting on the air. You can't see the plant's roots making a choice to grow in a new direction. But this I could really see. It put everything together for me in this tangible way. Here was a creature that knew I was touching it.
Yeah, that's quite something. And then you also explore the way in which plants seem to communicate.
Absolutely. So plants have this ability that we simply don't, which is to synthesize complex chemical compounds in their bodies and then release them through these pores on their leaves. And under a microscope, if you want to picture it, the pores look like little fish lips that open and close. It's actually very funny. And plants are making these compounds all the time. Some of them come with a lot of information that other plants use. So if a caterpillar, let's say, is attacking a plant and the plant is sensing being eaten, we've already talked about it being able to sense touch, it can also sample the saliva of the caterpillar that's chewing it and produce pesticides specific to that creature that's eating it. But it will also produce these compounds that float out of its pores and alert its kin, its fellow plants, that there's an attack coming. And those plants can boost their immune systems. They can start pumping their own leaves full of something that would make them taste bitter or something that would repel their pests. Or in some cases, they do this incredible thing where they receive the signal of an attack. And then they themselves produce new compounds that lure in the exact predator of whatever's eating it. So if there's a certain caterpillar eating a plant, it might send out pheromones or attractant chemicals that will lure in the parasitic wasp that will come and destroy the caterpillar that's eating it.
That is wild.
These are really complicated, multi-layered, multi-species conversations that are happening all the time, and we have no idea.
That is quite something. And it's manipulative as well. Plants almost seem, and I know the words are weird here, but it's like they're savvy enough to get other creatures to do their thing, including bees.
Absolutely. I always get these videos served to me on social media of like a crow using a stick to open a box. And we see that as a sign of intelligence. Here's this crow using a tool to solve a problem. Plants in some ways actually use other creatures as tools. So the yellow monkey flower, for example, has been found to lie to bees. They want bees to come to them so that they can get pollinated, but they will produce chemicals that tell the bees they have tons of pollen in their flowers, and the bees are themselves looking out for these signals. They want to go to flowers that have pollen. But making pollen is extremely expensive work for a flower. It takes a lot of energy. And, you know, if they don't have to, why should they? So they do this bait and switch. They send out the signal suggesting heaps of pollen to a bee brain. The bee shows up, nothing's there, but the flower gets pollinated anyway.
You also write about how plants recognize their fellow kin, their siblings. And this is a discovery made by Susan Dedley, an evolutionary plant ecologist at Hamilton, Ontario's McMaster University. Please tell me about that.
Yeah, she is the mother of kin recognition research. And in the early 2000s, she was working with an American sea rocket, which is this sort of beach plant that grows on the shores of the Great Lakes in these sandy places. And she found that they will actually behave preferentially to their kin. They will do things to protect their kin. And she's now found it in several species, which suggests it might be a widespread phenomena, but this is still a very early stage field, again, starting just in like 2007 or something. But we now know plants can exquisitely sense the genetic relatedness of whatever is growing beside them, to the point where they will often not compete as much with their kin. They will avoid shading their siblings. A plant in the cress family is able to move its leaves within a short period of time once they notice that there's a sibling growing beside them to avoid shading that sibling.
It's remarkable. How are plants able to do this? What is the evolutionary explanation?
Well, if you think about it, I mean, plants evolved to grow rooted in place, which is so different than, you know, we've evolved to run across long distances, to carry our brains in a neat little package and move around at will. Plants have this more diffuse awareness. So there's a spread out sense of awareness over their entire bodies. And they're modular. You know, you can snap off a branch and it won't kill the plant. They're actually designed to lose parts of themselves without losing any, like, pivotal organs. I mean, you can't cut off our head and it not have an impact, but you can do that for a plant. So when you think about that evolutionary history, it makes sense that there would be this kind of extreme sensitivity in all of its parts. What we don't know is how that sensitivity is coordinated as a whole. I mean, this is the problem. We haven't found that mechanism exactly. And yet, if you do something to one part of a plant, oftentimes the rest of the plant will respond in these ingenious ways.
This is the Sunday Magazine. I'm David Common in for Pia Chattopadhyay. And this morning I'm speaking with the Atlantic staff writer Zoe Schlanger about the latest research in so-called plant intelligence, as she lays out in her book, The Light Eaters. Zoe, this is fascinating in the lab, but there is a practical application to much of this research. Can you tell us about the sunflower farmers in Argentina who found a way to leverage some of these findings for more yield from their own plants?
Absolutely. Yeah, this was research done by a professor in Argentina. He planted genetically related sunflowers very close to each other. So the general rule of sunflower farming is you don't plant them very close together because they'll compete underground. They'll make these long, tenderly roots and attack each other, and they'll try and shade each other out above ground and spend less time or less energy making seeds, which is what a farmer wants. But when planted extremely close next to their siblings, it seemed that the stems of the sunflowers would grow at alternating angles to avoid shading each other. So in this study, they were able to get 47% more oil yield from sunflower seeds than they would in a traditionally planted field of sunflowers.
If humans acknowledge this idea of plant intelligence, there would be implications for human society. I mean, we go out and pick plants. We do all sorts of things to plants. You describe a way in which just a few years ago, in the state of Minnesota, there was a lawsuit against the state by wild rice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What does it tell you? What does it tell you, that lawsuit?
Yes, this was a lawsuit brought on behalf of the White Earth Band of Ojibwe, and they were suing the state, but they put wild rice as the main The main plaintiff in this case was wild rice as an organism. And they wrote that the rice had an inherent right to life, but not just to life, but to also to evolve, which I thought was an astounding thing to see in a piece of litigation. There was a pipeline that was being planned to run right through wild rice habitat, habitat that's extremely sensitive to changes. And this, they thought, would impede the wild rice's ability to thrive and evolve. That case ended up ultimately getting tossed out for lack of precedence. We don't have a lot of precedence in this realm of rights for plants, but it's definitely something a lot of legal scholars are looking at now. I mean, we've watched the entire animal rights movement has arisen just in the last 40 to 60 years. Now, with our findings about how sensitive and agentive and lively plants are in their own lives, it isn't completely beyond the pale to imagine a world in which plant rights are something that come up more often now.
I've got to ask, now these days when you're outside, when you're walking past things, are you seeing your natural surroundings in a different light, having gone through all of this, learning about plant intelligence?
Yeah. Yes, the experience of just going out of my house and walking to my nearby city park is a really uncanny one now. I walk in there and I have this acute sense that there's just a million little aliens going about their lives in there. And this way that I saw most plant life as this sort of wash of green before, I mean, I appreciated it. But now I know I'm looking at hundreds of different individuals, each of whom are engaged in these really intense plant dramas. They're sensing who's beside them. They're figuring out who to mate with. They are communicating both above ground and below ground. And they're doing very salty things. You know, there's a whole world of plants causing other plants to grow badly by exuding certain chemicals or, like I said, manipulating animals, insects, into doing certain things. So now when I'm in a place like that, I just have this awesome awareness. And it really brings back something that I remember from childhood. I think a lot of people have this experience of being a child and being much more aware of the liveliness of every living thing, just having that kind of awesome recognition that there is in every organism this element of living and activity that I think we all kind of lose as we grow up, and certainly around plants, which we're never taught as being these living, dynamic creatures. They're more like the decoration in our world. But now when I understand, when I look at these plants, I'm understanding something more fundamental about them, which is they are as exquisitely sensing as many other living things that we give a lot more credit to.
With the book on shelves now, you've gone back to your day job, to climate reporting. What have you learned about the way in which the research you've done, the conversations you've had around plant intelligence, how they might relate to climate change?
Well, I thought I'd come back to the beat with a little bit more hope, but I can't say I have. If I want to tell you the truth, it's that I don't have much more hope around climate change, but I do have this more of a attachment to the stakes. I think I've come to appreciate the evolutionary creativity that exists in every single species of plant. This line of evolutionary experimentation that each plant represents, and I feel much more aware of the shame and the tragedy of snuffing even any one of these out. Whether or not the plant has any use for us as humans is almost besides the point. I do feel that the plant, any given plant, has a right to its own life and to continue its riotous experiment on into the future. So I have gotten away from that numb feeling I talked about earlier. I really feel more connected to the material reality of climate change and also to this sense of enchantment that there's so much in this world to keep going as stewards of it. And how we feel about plants is really going to determine their future at this point. I mean, they literally made the habitable world that we live in. Our ability to breathe oxygen and every molecule of sugar that you've ever ingested that makes every single organ in your body work, that was all produced by plants when they've, you know, ate light in the first place. And yet their fate rests wholly in our hands now. And that's a reality I feel much more connected with now.
Zoe, you have reminded me how magnificent the natural world is. And I will certainly be taking my head out of my screens a bit more to just go and stare and think. And I want to thank you for that.
I'm so glad. I hope you do.
That is Zoe Schlanger, who's a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of The Light Eaters, How the Unseen World of Plant Intelligence Offers a New Understanding of Life on Earth.
I am speaking to you at a moment of grave crisis.
I'm Jeff Turner, and this is Recall. It's a series about history. Not the ancient past, but history that's still hot to the touch. In this first season, I explore a revolutionary political movement that brought a modern democracy to the brink. You can find Recall, How to Start a Revolution, on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Police have charged a fourth man in connection with the killing of the prominent Sikh separatist activist Hardip Singh Nijjar. That's on top of the three who were arrested and charged last week. Nijjar was shot outside his Gurdwara in Surrey, BC last June. Months later, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau accused India's government of being involved, an allegation India continues to reject, but one that set off a diplomatic spat. Now, new revelations have begun surfacing about this case. Police sources who spoke to CBC News said the three men charged last week in Nijjar's murder are affiliated with a gang from northern India's Punjab state. And that's raising bigger questions about whether they were acting on orders from the Indian government. CBC News senior reporter Evan Dyer first broke this story. I spoke with him about it on Friday before news that a fourth man had been charged. Here's our conversation. We've given broad strokes of how all of this began last June, but I wonder if we can just go back before that. Who was Hardip Singh Nijjar, and why did the Indian government of Narendra Modi see him as a threat?
Well, Hardip Singh Nijjar is a Sikh from the Punjab who came to Canada almost 30 years ago, 1997, and who was fairly prominent in the Khalistani or the separatist movement, especially after becoming the head of his Gurdwara in Surrey, BC, which was about 4 years ago. And he particularly began to come to the Indian government's attention because of a series of referenda that were held, that were organized by a close collaborator of his who's a joint U.S.-Canadian citizen who lives in the United States called Gurpatwant Singh Panun. And these referendums were organized under the heading of a group, Sikhs for Justice. They're non-binding, of course, because they're held only in the diaspora. India would never allow these to be held in India. And they tend to be attended by people who do believe that the Sikhs should have a separate state called Khalistan. So they tend to vote pretty heavily in favor, although the official vote tallies have not yet been announced because these referendums are happening in various different cities, one after the other, around the world, wherever there's a Sikh diaspora. The next one in Canada, for example, is at the end of July in Calgary, and it will undoubtedly irritate the Indian government a great deal. But that effort really was the main thing that India appeared to object to, although India would go further and say that Hardip Singh Nijjar was a terrorist, and they would accuse him of involvement with a group called Khalistan Tiger Force. That evidence they have never really provided to Canada, and Canadian investigators don't see him as someone who was involved in violence, in terrorism, or for that matter, in organized crime.
I suppose that goes to the question of whether the Indian government would see him as a threat, whether violence was involved or not.
Yes, I mean, the Indian government will tend to couch it in terms of violence and terrorism, but I think that there's no doubt that they object to these referendums very strenuously, and they've objected in the past also to various protests held outside of their embassies and consulates. You know, gestures like burning an Indian flag, for example, tend to irritate the Indian government a great deal. But when they make complaints against people, when they ask other countries to take action against people, they couch it in the language of terrorism.
Right. Okay. And we have seen the Indian government being critical of the Canadian government. We've also seen the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, come out after the murder of Nijjar and say there's credible information that the Indian government was involved. So yeah. That brings us to these three men who've now been charged in Nijjar's murder. Who are they?
They are three men in their 20s, all from Punjab or Haryana state in northern India. Their names are Karanbrar, Karanpreet Singh, and Kamalpreet Singh. And they are affiliates, investigators have told me, of a well-known organized crime group in India called the Lawrence Bishnoi Gang, which, as its name suggests, was founded by a Lawrence Bishnoi, who was a sort of a student politician. That's actually the milieu that this gang grew out of, student politics, which may sound odd in a Canadian context, but I should mention that in Punjab, often political figures have their sort of entourage, which is often armed or can be armed at times. The politics there has often seen assassinations, kidnappings, intimidation, and things of that nature. And so he came out of that kind of milieu and branched out, it appears, into extortion, targeting, for example, the liquor mafia there, targeting mines and mining operations, prominent business people. And the Indian government and Indian media have accused him of running an army of hundreds of gunmen, guns for hire, who are the collectors and enforcers of that extortion ring, although he's behind bars and has been for several years. Lawrence Bishnoi lives in an Indian maximum security prison in Gujarat, but that hasn't prevented him, it appears, either from communicating with his gang or, for that matter, from going on social media and claiming responsibility for killings or from giving television interviews. So there's been for some time an odd relationship between Lawrence Bishnoi and Indian authorities. And the government of Canada believes that the three men who it's arrested are all affiliates of that group who came over to Canada in the last few years using the student visa system in most, if not all, cases. It's not clear if it's just most or all of the people who came over, and of rapidly leaving education if they ever pursued studies at all and going to criminality quite quickly and becoming involved in this conspiracy, which culminated on 18th of June last year in the assassination of Hardeep Singh Nijjar.
Is the thinking that they came to Canada to expand the reach of this organized criminal group?
There's some question about whether they came on their own initiative as individuals, whether they came as part of a gang move to Canada. Certainly they are affiliated with that gang, and that gang has other affiliates in North America, not only in Canada, but also in California. Or did they come as Indian government agents? That was their purpose always to be here, perhaps as sleeper agents. And I can say that that is actually a topic of active investigation, going back and looking at exactly why they came here. Did they come here with this plan already sort of somewhat formed, or at least standing by for further instructions, or were they recruited after they came here? I can't really answer that question. I think I can say only that it's a topic of active investigation.
Now, Canadian police have not said much about this connection publicly, but it would certainly seem to raise a very troubling alarm for this country.
It's not unusual, actually. It's the fastest growth area of national security investigations is the crossover between governments and organized crime. I mean, you can look at another country, the Islamic Republic of Iran, which was recently trying to assassinate one of its dissidents in the United States. And who did they hire? Well, according to the U.S. indictment, they hired two Hells Angels, two bikers from British Columbia. And that is a case that's going to go to trial, a murder conspiracy. So this would not be the first time that the investigators who I've been talking to, who were also involved in that Iranian case, this would not be the first time they've seen it. They would say that, in fact, many governments have learned that this is a good way to operate. It gives you a certain amount of plausible deniability. You can imagine, for example, if the three people who had been arrested for the Hardeep Singh Nijjar killing had been Indian official agents, that would be a whole lot harder for India to respond to. The fact that they weren't has allowed India to say, well, these are just gangsters killing gangsters, or terrorists killing terrorists. It has nothing to do with us. And even to point the finger of blame at Canada, as we saw Indian Foreign Minister Jaishankar do, and say, see, this is the Canadians' fault for letting all these people into their country. We warned them and told you so. But this is really their problem, and we have nothing to worry about.
This is not the only murder, the only killing that has come to the attention of authorities, one involving an 11-year-old boy in Edmonton. Can you tell me about that?
Right. So this is one of the things that I reported at the time that I reported on the arrests. I also reported that investigators are looking at these same alleged hit squad members in three other killings. So two homicides, one of which was a double homicide. The first one actually happened just 2 days after Prime Minister Trudeau rose in the House and made that allegation against India on September 18th. September 20th, 2 days later, a man called Sukhdul Singh Gill was killed in an apartment in Winnipeg. Neighbors heard about 11 shots and he was found dead. He is a person who has sort of one foot in the world of politics, Khalistani separatist politics, and one foot in the world of organized crime, which makes his case interesting because there would actually be motives for both the government of India to kill him, but also there would be motives for the gang, the Bishnoi gang, to want to kill him because he was a gang enemy of theirs. He belonged to a rival Punjabi organization called the Devinder Bambiha Gang and had been accused by Lawrence Bishnoi and others of killing two people who were close to Lawrence Bishnoi and the Bishnoi gang. So right there, that would be one motive for his killing. But then he had also been listed just the day before he was shot in Winnipeg by the Indian government as a terrorist. And his picture and name had been published on a list in India literally the day before. So motives abound, let's say, in his case. 6 weeks after that, in Edmonton, somebody else who was affiliated with organized crime and less political, perhaps much more just an organized crime figure and quite a senior one, a man called Harpreet Uppal, was shot in Edmonton. And it was he who was traveling with his son. He had his 11-year-old son in the car, and he had a friend of his son. And the killers not only shot Mr. Uppal himself, who I believe was 41, but also his 11-year-old son. Police there say, and I'm assuming this is either from witness or video evidence, because they said it very conclusively, that he was not killed accidentally. The son was deliberately shot as well. This was not a stray round intended for his father. The other boy fortunately survived unhurt.
Evan, I have to go back a number of decades, because this is not the first instance of friction between Canada and India on the issue of those who would advocate for a separate Sikh state. We can go back certainly as far as 1985 and the Air India bombing. Yeah. What is the way in which the Indian government broadly, but in particular this Indian government of Narendra Modi, views those who would advocate for a separate state in foreign countries, and particularly in Canada?
Well, I mean, the hallmark, of course, of the Modi government is Hindu nationalism and Indian nationalism. So within the country, Hindutva, you know, the Hindu majority will be the dominant group, and its values and mores will dominate over all others. But also projecting that outwards, nationalism of a sort of a revitalized India that will no longer take sort of second place to anybody in the world. And we've seen Narendra Modi talk about how India is going to address threats to its national security much more aggressively. Even actually, he's in an election campaign right now to get a third term, but even in the last election campaign, he was making comments about going after India's enemies in other countries. And it was, I think, widely assumed that he was just talking about Pakistan. But I think now that we've seen him actually, you know, the Indian government being accused of plots in G7 countries like the US and Canada, people realize that he was referring to something much bigger. In this current election campaign, he's done it again. And he made a remark in a speech where he said, India is no longer a country that sends dossiers. And this is a reference to India, you know, sending files on certain people to other countries and saying, could you take action about this person? Could you, you know, consider extraditing or curtailing the activities of this or that member of the Indian diaspora? He said, we're not the country that sends dossiers anymore. Now we go into the house and we kill the person in the house. And, you know, in the context of the allegations against India, both in Canada and the United States, that is exactly what they've been doing. That comment is very, very revealing, I think. And it tells you that India is both at the same time officially denying through its foreign minister mainly and its foreign ministry spokesman that it had an involvement in this killing, acknowledging that Indian agents were planning to kill Gurpatman Singh Panoon in the United States, but claiming that they were merely rogue agents. And then at the same time, you know, Narendra Modi himself going out and giving speeches where he basically says, yep, this is our policy. We're killing people. We're killing our enemies abroad.
And how's that viewed in India?
Well, I think Indians who support the BJP, Narendra Modi's base, have generally welcomed this. I mean, they see this as India asserting itself. It's not going to stand for this nonsense anymore. And it's not going to allow a country like Canada to act as a harbor, safe harbor for people who threaten India. It's going to take action. So on that level, I think that this has been a popular policy with his own base. Having said that, I don't think that many people in his own base would have imagined that he would be that India would be using the Bishnoi gang. I think that people would rather imagine sort of the dashing Indian intelligence agent of the Bollywood movie, perhaps being the person who goes into enemy territory and carries out these bold actions on behalf of India. The Bishnoi gang is notorious in India. It does not have a good reputation. Actually, right now, it's in the news again because the Bishnois have sworn to assassinate one of India's best-known actors, Salman Khan, and in fact, they'd shot up his house in Mumbai just a couple of weeks ago. So this is a gang that's known for extortion, murder, drug trafficking, trying to kill one of the country's best-loved movie stars. Mm-hmm. So I do think that that perhaps, if this is widely known in India, if it becomes widely known in India, it might cause people even within the BJP to have some pause about the tactics being used.
And the threat, to be clear, to and from the Bollywood actor is about an animal he hunted.
That's right. He poached a black buck. And the Bishnoi name actually comes from a sect. It's a tribal and religious sect of people who venerate animals, trees, living things. The Bishnoi gang certainly does not operate that way, but the sect does. And Salman Khan, several years ago, while filming a movie, allegedly poached a black buck, which is considered sacred by the Bishnois. And that's the origin of that vendetta.
Okay, let's step away from India and step towards Indo-Canadians, and particularly the Sikh diaspora here in this country. What have you heard from that community about their concerns?
Well, they're relieved about the arrests. I think that that's something that the whole, you know, especially in Surrey, people have been waiting to see somebody come into custody for that very brazen daylight shooting. I think at the same time, very few people would have the illusion that this is, you know, the end of the Indian government's resources. The Indian government obviously has huge resources, and there's a vast diaspora in Canada, and I think most people would assume that it still includes people who are members of the Bishnoi organization. People claiming to be Bishnois have extorted businesses in BC for some time. Whether they are really members of the Bishnoi or affiliates of the Bishnoi organization, or just opportunists using a name that inspires fear, or a mix of both, we don't know. I spoke to the former Solicitor General of BC, former Minister of Public Safety, Kashid, and he says he thinks it's both. But there are, I think, clearly Bishnois present in North America. One of them, Goldie Brar, a very senior member of the Bishnoi organization, a sign of a right-hand man, actually, to Lawrence Bishnoi, was on Canada's most wanted, 25 most wanted list for some time, and he still remains on Canada's BOLO or most wanted list, although he's believed now to be in California. Lawrence Bishnoi's brother, Anmol, probably also in California. He showed up in a video shot at a person's house there recently. So the Bishnois are in North America. And I think that even if the Bishnois were not in North America, the Indian government could turn to other potential, you know, hitmen, shooters, who would be willing to offer their services for hire. So as long as that policy exists, and as long as India has not been deterred from pursuing that policy, I think people in the Sikh community understand that this danger has not gone away.
We've only just had arrests. We're a long way, likely, from a trial, from a prosecution. But is there the expectation that Crown prosecutors would try to tie those arrested in a public setting, in a courthouse, to agents of India?
I think so, yes. I mean, we saw in the announcement of these arrests that the police were reluctant to discuss those connections to India. They said that that wasn't the time, but I've had many conversations with them about this, not only with the investigators in the Nijjar case, but also with other people in the government and, you know, the national security apparatus. And it's been just uniform. Everybody that I've spoken to has no doubt that this was ordered by the Indian government. There is some doubt about the other two homicides that occurred after the Nijjar homicide. Whether those were being freelanced by Bishnois or if they were ordered by the Indian government, that still remains a little less clear. But I think everybody that I've spoken to has said that as far as they're concerned, this was not only ordered by the Indian government, but ordered from the top of the Indian government and could not have happened without the knowledge of people at the very top of the Indian government. And that's not only because of things like signals intercepts, which show this moving up the chain of command back into India, and instructions and money, for example, coming from India to help to pay for the Panun assassination, for example. But also because it goes wide. It involves a large number of Indian officials. It involves the use of Indian diplomatic channels. And that really means that the rogue agent theory is very hard to believe. And we, you know, actually two former heads of CSIS talked about this a short while ago, Dick Fadden and Ward Elcock, and they both agreed that in their experience, the Indian government is a very vertical hierarchical organization where people just don't go out on a limb on their own. You don't see rogue operations. And this was so large and involved so many people in so many different places that it would never really have been possible to believe that this could be a rogue operation.
Evan Dyer, it's absolutely fascinating. Thank you very much for your journalism on this.
Thanks for having me.
That is Evan Dyer, senior reporter with CBC News. I spoke with him Friday before police in British Columbia announced that they had charged a fourth man in connection with the killing of Hardeep Singh Nijjar. This is the Sunday Magazine on CBC Radio, Sirius XM 169, and the CBC Listen app. I'm David Common. When it comes to battleground states likely to decide this year's U.S. presidential election, Michigan certainly at the top of the list. Donald Trump, the presumptive Republican nominee, eked out a victory in Michigan in 2016 by just over 10,000 votes. In the minds of many, it was Michigan that elected Trump that year. Joe Biden, who's seeking re-election with Democrats, did carry Michigan in 2020, but as the November vote looms, polls show Michigan is once again too close to call. And one group of voters in particular is likely to swing with huge impact for the state and the country. They are blue-collar workers. Sunday Magazine producer Pete Mitten recently spent some time in Michigan's biggest city to hear what's on workers' minds there. Here's Pete with his documentary, Detroit Takes the Wheel.
Voting started at 6 o'clock this morning, so we started with all the sweets. A lot of hostess and stuff.
At a union hall in Detroit, it's election day, of a different kind. They're electing union reps. It's a chilly April morning, but here in the parking lot outside, there's a tent and a fire pit, and it's a party.
Well, that's the way you're supposed to do it, right?
We're in River Rouge, an industrial part of the city that's home to a massive steel mill, the Great Lakes Steelworks. And these are steel workers. Eric Miller with baskets of Twinkies and cupcakes.
Get you some sweets.
And Scott Labine manning a table full of hot food.
Well, we got walking tacos and hot dogs. You want something to eat?
I'd never heard of a walking taco.
Walking taco, you take the bag of Doritos, you bust it up, you cut off the end, you put in some taco meat, cheese, lettuce, pico. All right.
Yeah, there you go.
Highly recommended, by the way. But of course, there's a bigger vote looming over everything in the United States right now. One with much less of a party atmosphere. And when it comes to the presidential elections, America's waiting to see which way blue-collar voters like the steelworkers here in Detroit will swing. For generations, going back to the New Deal and Franklin Roosevelt, working-class voters have been the Democratic Party's base. But election after election has shown that's changing. Andrea Hunter is the USW 1299's current president. We met in her office inside the Union Hall.
Hello, sir. How you doing?
I'm well.
A place that feels like it's from a different era, with its old wooden paneling, plastic 70s furniture, and faded worker solidarity posters on the wall. I asked her how she thinks these steel workers will vote this fall.
It's pretty mixed. My membership is 50-50.
All right.
Oh, yes, for a fact. Yes, 50-50.
She thinks fully half will vote for Trump, despite what she sees as some pretty good reasons for workers to support Biden.
Biden is the first president in decades that brought American manufacturer back here. And a lot of people don't realize that. And it's not being spoken enough. So that's one of the reasons here. Michigan, as I tell everybody, is purple. And we're purple because we go back and forth.
Back outside at the fire pit, I asked a mill worker named Bob Kemper what the top issues are for him when he thinks about this fall.
Well, I'll tell you what, and honestly, number one thing that's important to us and it's important to every American, and the lie that they tell you otherwise, is jobs.
Yep. Once you have a job, you're fat and happy, and you can feed your family, then you like to get into all the other issues. But jobs is number one, and it's always been number one, and it always will be number one.
The steel mill here shut down its blast furnaces and laid off more than 1,000 workers 4 years ago. And for the 500 or so who are left, their jobs are far from guaranteed. The mill's parent company, U.S. Steel, is in talks to be taken over by a Japanese company.
Right now, we're against that. We're against that for multiple reasons. I mean, obviously, we believe that steel should be produced domestically by domestic ownership.
Donald Trump says he'd stop the deal, while the Biden White House has said it's giving the deal, quote, serious scrutiny. It's one thing weighing on the minds of the workers here, but not the only one. The decision they'll make this fall isn't simple. A few minutes after speaking with Bob Kemper, I find myself speaking with another Bob Kemper.
Bob Kemper, that's my son.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought he was Kemper.
Yeah, we are. Actually, our first name's Marion. Just like John Wayne.
Bob Sr. is retired, but he worked at the same mill.
Spent most of my career was there. Me and my buddy Dave Ewart, we worked a swing turn together for 20-some years. Now we're both retired. We got property up north. Life is good.
That's nice.
Got 26 acres between us.
Did you catch that? Bob and his buddy Dave, who worked together at the factory for 20 years, have cottages next to each other now in northern Michigan. He's living the dream. And he told me he's voting for Biden, no doubt about it. He's an old-school Democrat. But for folks like his son or grandkids, that dream of putting in your time at the factory, then retiring up north, well, it's disappearing. And that's one thing that's been driving workers to Trump. I asked the union president, Andrea Hunter, who's 1 week away from retirement herself, how she feels about the Biden-Trump rematch on the horizon.
You worried about this fall?
Of course. Terrified. Terrified.
Yes, sir. You here for the meeting? Oh, hey, what's up, Virgil? Excuse me, what's up? Hey.
In an election year, 6 months is an eternity. It's also no time at all. And so campaigns here are kicking into higher gear now.
Good to see you again. Yep.
It's about 7 p.m. on a Wednesday night, and the Northwest Detroit Democratic Club is holding a meeting to plan for the election. Fabian Hill helped found the club about a year ago.
What our mission is we are to inform and educate electors about important issues that will increase voter participation in the Michigan democratic process. Let them know where they go vote.
As we speak, she's setting tables and chairs out around the room, an old storefront. Well, a couple dozen people file in for an evening of speeches from community leaders and politicians. Fabian's an auto worker.
I work for the Stellantis warehouse, which is the Mopar warehouse. We pick parts and send them out to the depots, and they get shipped overseas too.
And she's a United Auto Workers Union member. So she was on strike last fall. It was a historic work stoppage that yielded a historic contract for workers and the industry. It also made history by bringing Joe Biden to the picket line, a first for a sitting president.
That was just awesome sauce in an election year, you know. He was actually hugging one of our 1248 UAW members, so we thought that was awesome, you know.
Fabian's also benefited from a major Biden policy, student loan forgiveness.
I had student loans and interest just sitting there and adding up and adding up. So once I got the job with the UAW, I was able to make my payments, and on time, just seemed like it wasn't moving. The needle just wasn't moving. And then the president was working his magic and doing the things that happened, and sure as my name, 30 days later, I had that congratulations letter saying, you know, you're no longer responsible for it. And I was like...
With the loan forgiven, her credit improved, and she was able to take on some long overdue repairs at her home. It's meant a lot to her and other working-class African-American voters here in Detroit. So has a new policy capping the price on insulin. But she's afraid the message isn't getting through.
People ask, what have the Democrats, I've heard conversations, people ask, what have Democrats done? And you'll hear people say, nothing. And the first thing that comes out their mouth, Trump gave us money.
And to be clear, that was COVID payments?
Yes, that was that.
You might remember the controversy in 2020 when Donald Trump had his name added to the stimulus checks mailed out to 35 million Americans. It was unprecedented, to include the president's name on the checks. But it seems he knew what he was doing.
And that's the only thing that stuck in their head is what was given to them, you know. And if they only were so cognizant of what's actually going on, the underlying of things, they might really change their mind.
Hi, Peter.
Hi, Terry. How are you?
Good. I was going to ask you, how do we do this? Do you want to...
And of course, it's not just the Democrats gearing up for the fall.
Now it might get a little warm if I put the windows up, but we'll try.
This is Terry Bowman, another auto worker.
I worked for Ford as an hourly auto worker since September of 96, so about 27 and a half years ago.
I met him outside a Denny's restaurant after his shift, and we sat in his white Ford F-150 truck.
I grew up in a union household. My dad worked for Ford. I had a couple uncles that worked for Ford. I had cousins that worked for Ford. Siblings that work for Ford.
But unlike his parents, Terry tells me he's always been a Republican. And back in 2016, when Donald Trump first came on the scene, he says he had no problem getting other blue-collar workers, traditional Democrats, to come out and support Trump.
When we would do rallies and I would announce myself on stage as a blue-collar auto worker, the place would erupt. And we knew that there was a lot of blue-collar auto workers, not only auto workers, but blue-collar workers, period, that maybe have not voted for a Republican in a long time, but was willing to cross the aisle and vote for Donald Trump.
Terry tells me he's always resented being forced to join a union as an auto worker, and he hated NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which Donald Trump campaigned against and renegotiated with Mexico and Canada. Beyond that, though, Terry says that Donald Trump just gets working people.
There's something about Donald Trump that I don't think the other side understands. This is a man, he may be a billionaire, but he has a way of talking to the everyday man that people like. Perhaps it's because he has spent his career on job sites talking to electricians and steel workers and people who are building his buildings, but he's very comfortable and very practiced at talking to the blue-collar type of worker. And workers seem to really respond to his bluntness, to the fact that he's not a well-voiced politician.
John Selleck is a longtime Republican operative in Michigan. He ran Mitt Romney's presidential campaign here in 2012, and he sees something deeper at work in the way Donald Trump has connected with blue-collar workers in his state.
Other Republicans had talked about tax issues, welfare, whether that was fair or not, or who got welfare and who did not, things like that. That messaging had been there, but Trump took it and essentially put it on steroids. He not only amplified their anger back to them, but he told those people who became those voters, I not only hear you, it's okay to be mad. Let it rip. Be mad about anything and everything. That's why we see him at these rallies able to go for over an hour and have the crowd still paying attention, because he's got a litany of things that sometimes I think the mainstream media just thinks he's complaining about, but I think it's safe to say he knows what he's doing. He's talking to the concerns and the frustrations and the sadness and the anger of a whole lot of blue-collar workers who didn't go to college, who did not have to go to college because of the kind of jobs that existed here. They weren't looking to be rich. They were just looking to have vacation time, maybe to have a small cottage somewhere by the time they retired, and they moved up north. That's what they were looking to have. It wasn't asking a whole lot. And all that was being taken away from them. And Donald Trump was not only telling them, I heard you, but unleashing them to be angry about it. He unleashed an entire movement.
There's a new issue in this year's presidential elections that's critical for Michigan working class voters. Something new to be angry about. It's an economic issue that's sort of becoming a cultural one too. EVs. Here's Terry Bowman again, the Trump-supporting Ford worker.
If people want electric vehicles, the automobile companies are going to know that. And if they're not offering them, then they're going to get hurt in the long run. It's when you mandate it and when you force it, I think, is where the chaos starts.
The Biden administration doesn't call its EV policy a mandate, but it has brought in strict new emission limits and subsidies that are pushing the market toward electric vehicles. On a recent swing through Michigan, Donald Trump warned that EVs will be, quote, a bloodbath for Michigan workers. And that's a point that Terry echoes.
I do think workers are right to be fearful. There are thousands of jobs in engine plants, tens of thousands of jobs in engine plants and transmission plants, not only here in Michigan, but around the country, with these electric vehicle mandates means thousands and thousands of job losses.
EVs are made with fewer parts, and battery plants have been opening in the U.S. South, in areas with less union presence. But when it comes to exactly what the EV transition will mean for workers, well, it may just be too early to tell. I spoke with Phoebe Wall Howard, who covers the auto industry for the Detroit Free Press.
All automakers are in a shakeup at this time. But at this time, while there is concern about job loss, we have not witnessed any job loss at all.
Still, she says, workers don't know how to feel about the EV transition yet.
You have people who are very optimistic. You have people who are very pessimistic.
And will that uncertainty in the auto industry and all the Michigan jobs connected to it play out at the ballot box this year? Well, Phoebe, who's a sixth generation Detroiter herself, says absolutely.
We cannot assume anything in terms of blue collar voters being pro Biden or pro Trump. We can't even assume it by day, because it pivots all the time. It's a live animal moving.
At Stellantis, the company that makes Jeeps and Ram trucks, there have been ongoing layoffs in recent weeks, owing in part to the huge capital expenditures the company has made as it becomes more focused on EVs.
Yeah. What happens, Stellantis is doing a lot of layoffs recently.
That's the company where Fabian Hill, the Democratic organizer we met earlier, works.
There's a chance that, more to come. I've just heard at my facility.
And when we spoke, she just found out her job could be on the line in just a few days.
So then we just heard, too, that they were meeting today to lay off potentially another 2025 at the warehouse, yeah.
So you're waiting to hear this week?
Yes, I'm waiting to hear that this week, uh-huh.
What will it mean for you?
Well, and if it is, I'm just going to stay busy and work harder until my political family are trying to get people registered to vote.
What's your family situation?
It's just me. My son's about to get married. I have no grandbabies. Well, I have two coming into the family, but hey, I'm all right. I'll be okay. I got my little furry doggy, and hey, we'll be fine.
Well, electric vehicles may be a flashpoint this year, but according to Andrea Hunter, the Steelworkers Union head, the real reason that blue-collar workers, and white men especially, are flirting with Trump again is the same as it was in 2020 and 2016. Reasons that few are likely to say out loud.
They cannot, I can sit there and tell you why I support Biden. I can sit there and tell you because I'm a political person and I like the way he's voted on the side of women and the side of labor, okay? But why they don't want to do that? No, because see... Because they really don't want to tell you the truth. The truth is, it is, like I told you, racism, sexism. Because when you ask them questions, this is what I can't get a Republican to do for me yet. I mean a Trumpster, because a lot of Republicans don't support Trump. This is what I can't get him to do for me yet. What has he done for you and your family to make you want to vote for him? He speaks his mind. On what? You know what I'm saying? They really believe they're feeding into his misogynistic and racist point of views.
It was a serious challenge to speak with Republicans in Michigan, and in particular, folks who had left the Democratic Party to vote for Trump. Even Terry Bowman, the Trump-supporting auto worker, only agreed to speak with me after dozens of calls and emails and texts. When I learned about an election planning meeting of local Republicans taking place after hours at a gun range in Detroit, I sent a note saying I'd like to drop by. I didn't hear back, but I knocked on the door anyway.
Hi, is it Ann?
Yes.
My name's Peter. I sent a note to you last week. I don't know if you saw it or not. But...
Now's not the time.
Okay.
Okay. I might just hang out, and as people leave, I might ask if they'd be willing to chat with me for a few minutes.
Not on property.
No.
I can't have it.
Was told to leave.
Yeah, no.
On my property with my federal firearms license, it can't take place on the property. You want to hang out at the sidewalk, you can hang out at the sidewalk. That's city property.
No, I would just only leave.
And pushed out the door.
Pardon me?
Nothing.
On the sidewalk outside, I asked if any of the people filing out from the meeting would chat about their views. One woman, who refused to go on the record, told me that she'd been a Democrat most of her life, but felt that the party had left her. She said she didn't love the Republican Party either, but felt that Trump was better on the economy, on foreign policy, and on, quote, loving America. Only one person would speak on the record about why she's voting for Trump.
Yeah, well, you know, they said things are getting better, but they're not. And that's a big fat lie. You know, I don't know where they're getting this from. It's probably getting better for the, you know, for certain classes of people that are in politics and playing these games. But for the average person, it's not.
Patricia Farmer, who's 80 years old and black, used to be a Democrat, too.
Oh, years ago.
What made you change?
Well, the Lord put it in my heart that it was the right thing. You know, I mean, look at it. You know, I can't go along with all that crazy stuff. You know, black people are going to be voting for Trump, and that's why they want to get rid of him.
A survey from this spring showed that 17% of black Americans would vote for Trump today. That's up from 8% in 2016 and 12% in 2020. And that's something of a concern for Michigan Democrats, like Wayne County Commissioner Jonathan Kinlock.
The entire state, when you look at it from a political lens, the state is red. And to that little area in the southeast corner of the state of Michigan, full of black folks, turn it blue.
I met with Kinlock at a UAW session rallying auto workers for the Biden presidential campaign. And of all the speakers that afternoon, by far the one who got the biggest reaction from these workers was Reverend Wendell Anthony, president of the Detroit NAACP. His message? Workers need to stop voting against their own interests.
Who, by their voting records, do not support us. You better hear what I'm saying. It ain't about personality. It's about policy. It's about those policies that they vote for. That directly impacts you and your family. We need to stop being stupid and electing people who do not support us. And once they get in office, you never see them again. Supporting people that are against workers. Supporting people that come and hire counterfeit workers.
Before I left Detroit, I met once more with Fabian Hill.
So today is people's last day. I think they laid off three.
I met her after her warehouse shift had ended to see if she got a layoff notice that day.
So no, I wasn't affected this go round, which is a good thing. Out here, knowing there's really not as good money paying as the automotive industry, you know, and I was very fortunate to be able to get in here and keep this job, so... Feeling okay, but I still feel for the other people, though, you know.
That was 2 weeks ago. Last week, I checked in with her again, and her shift had been changed. She says if more layoffs do come, she's sure now that she'll be next. But she's still hopeful it won't be permanent. Fabian says she's still on Team Biden, but there's a lot of road to cover between now and the election this fall.
Pete Mitten is a producer here on the Sunday Magazine. His documentary was produced with support from CBC's Audio Doc Unit. I'm I'm David Kalman. Before we close up shop today on the Sunday Magazine, let's take a moment to note Mother's Day. Despite what you may think, it was not invented by greeting card companies. It was actually established in North America by a woman named Anna Jarvis, all in the name of honoring her own mom. And Anna went toe-to-toe with flower companies, U.S. presidents, and charities to uphold her singular, sentimental vision. Here's history professor Catherine Lane Antonellini with that story.
The story that Anna herself would tell is that when she was a young girl, she often heard her own mother just kind of wish that there would be a day that honored mothers. And then when Mrs. Jarvis dies in 1905, Anna, by her account, she's standing by her mother's grave. And I'm like, I'm going to do what my mother asked. So she starts this movement. So she selected the second Sunday in May as Mother's Day because, one, she always wanted it to fall on a Sunday. She naively thought that would save it from being commercialized if it fell on a holy day. And she picked the second Sunday in May because it was the closest Sunday to the anniversary of her mother's death. The white carnation is the official flower of Mother's Day. She selected the white carnation, she claims, originally because it was one of her mother's favorite flower. She will go on to claim she liked the carnation too, because when the flower dies, the petals don't drop. So she would kind of equate the carnation petals not falling off, but kind of closing in on each other as a mother's hug. Right, as a mother's love that never dies. Then she wonders why the floral industry runs with it. I know, it's perfect.
This Mother's Day, thank her for all she passed on to you by giving her a Teleflora bouquet that's vibrant, beautiful, unforgettable, just like her.
She ultimately saw the day as a homecoming. Go home and spend time with your mother. That's it. She specifically wanted it to be possessive singular in its spelling. It's not all mothers, it's your mother. You spend the day with your mother. The day becomes a national holiday in 1914. It's also the same time the suffrage movement is peaking.
We're clearly soldiers in petty coats and dauntless crusaders for women's votes.
So it's not, I don't think, a coincidence that at the same time we have women who are pushing, women who want to go to college, women who want to have careers, women who don't want to take the same path as their own mother, women who want the right to vote. At the same time we're having this new generation of women push the boundaries, we have a holiday that's trying to say, oh, no, 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 this is what true womanhood is.
Political equality.
Anna Jarvis was a very strong woman. She's impressive and very determined woman. And eventually, her ego also drives it. She's 41 years old when her mother dies. And at 41, Anna Jarvis is single. With, you know, she'll never marry, have children of her own. So Mother's Day kind of becomes her baby. And she will nurture it, protect it for, you know, the rest of her adult life. About 1912 is when it really starts to escalate. She incorporates herself. She claims copyright. So to her, then, her holidays is not a public holiday. It's hers. By that time, floral industry is going, well, you know, it's our holiday now. And she's like, no. So when she copyrights herself, she threatens to sue everybody. She made the newspaper all the time. God bless her. 1923, she crashed a convention of candy makers because she was mad at them. In 1925, she was actually arrested for disorderly conduct. There was American War Mothers, which is an organization that still exists. It was for women who had children who were serving. And so they would fundraise around Mother's Day. They would sell white carnations every Mother's Day. And so Anna hated that. How dare they use that holiday to profit. And these women were using it to raise funds for the organization, but it still bothered Anna. So for whatever reason, the American War Mothers in 1925 decided to have a convention in Philadelphia, which was a mistake. You know, don't, if you're fighting with Anna Jarvis, don't have conventions in the town in which she lives. They do, and she crashes it. She comes and she's screaming. There's one article depicting them like a, almost like they're standing in the middle of the street, and she's screaming at the presidents of this organization, so much so that they call the police, and Anna is arrested for disorderly conduct. But she's in her hometown, and she's drawn, and she comes in front of the magistrate, and the magistrate states, well, you know, I know who you are, and I love my mother, and I love the day, so all charges are dropped. There's motherhood as you see it when you're a child, and then when you become a mother, you clearly see another side of it. Anna, because she never has the experience of being a mother, only sees motherhood like a child would. Like the idea that one thing that a mother wants to be is constantly surrounded by her children. When I have friends on Mother's Day who her gift is that they leave her alone. I mean, that's her gift. So it was that very kind of domestic, sentimental view. When Mrs. Jarvis envisioned a Mother's Day, Mrs. Jarvis was a mother of 13 children, but only four of them are going to live to see adulthood. So she saw motherhood as mothers themselves serving their community. And it stemmed from her early experiences. It's the early 19th century, and child infant mortality is reality, right? There's all the ways that your children can die horrible deaths from accident, particularly disease. So she is influenced by her brother, who is a doctor, and he's one of the earliest doctors in what is now West Virginia to be interested in the notion of public health. So she gets informed from her brother on the best kind of practices to help stop the spread of disease. So she formed these Mother's Day work clubs, as they were known. And it was really just women coming together in the neighboring counties. And they would educate women. And they, if there was a epidemic, they would help quarantine families and make sure they had everything while they're quarantined. So they really kind of worked hard together. And then when the Civil War breaks out, her mothers help when soldiers are encamped in their communities. So Anna is born in 1864. So she does, of course, will never remember her mother, the activist, and just never writes about her that way. Her other contemporaries who write about her being this kind of very community figure, but all in the name of mothers. As mothers, we have a responsibility to mother others. Anna hated it when people tried to use her day for activism or for political aggrandizement or making a profit. But there is still room for it to be used in other ways. I mean, Anna could never shut all that down. And which is, I think it's why it's so dynamic. So we can have a broader vision, a more complex vision of motherhood, and Mother's Day can adapt to it. Yes, it could just be spending the day with your mother and taking her out to brunch or whatever, but it also can be, I'm going to be active and what can I do to help mother my community? I think there's room for that.
Catherine Lane Antolini is the author of Memorializing Motherhood, Anna Jarvis, and the Struggle for Control of Mother's Day. And that's it for this week on the Sunday Magazine. Our producers are Levi Garber, Brianna Goss, Andrea Wong, Adam Killick, Samantha Louie, Pete Mitten, and Aronde Williams. We had additional help this week from audio technician Juliana Romanek and studio director Susan McReynolds. Our senior producer is Howard Goldenthal. Our executive producer, Brian Colton. I'm David Common. Thanks very much for listening. Happy Mother's Day, and enjoy the rest of your weekend.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.